Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Like, after week one of the NFL season, we are bound to get some overreactions. We know this. Like, if you're smart, you do not give in to them. You don't suddenly start saying things like, oh, Jacksonville, that's a team to watch. Jacksonville, they might run the table. Or the 49ers, man, they're in big trouble already. You don't give in to things like that. Now, let me move on to the state of Florida. We all know that when you think of Florida and everything in it, it's about as weird as it gets. We know this about Florida. And even knowing that, there are still some really bizarre things coming out of Tampa as it relates to Tom Brady. Bizarre things in the wake of Brady gifting the Saints a couple of INTs, including a pick six. In fact, within a few hours after that game ended, Brady takes right to Instagram and he posts this quote. Let me quote this now. In the midst of hate, I found there was, within me, an invincible love. In the midst of tears, I found there was, within me, an invincible smile. In the midst of chaos, I found there was, within me, an invincible calm. I realized through it all that in the midst of winter, I found there was, within me, an invincible summer. And that makes me happy. For it says that no matter how hard the world pushes against me, within me, there is something stronger, something better, pushing right back. End of quote. There you have it. The alleged GOAT has one bad regular season game, and he sprints to the gram to reference Albert Camus. I mean, I think it's not totally clear that Big Al wrote the entire piece, or maybe just a line or two. Either way, if this is the start of something new for Brady, where he jumps on Instagram after games to drop some French-Algerian existentialism, I mean, great, I guess. A little weird. But then again, Brady is a little weird. But if that quote is in any way related to losing on Sunday, then dude, you got to get your head straight. You got to get right. Man, it's one game. You don't need to be going all emo with it after one game. I mean, overreact much? You lose to the Saints, and now you're dropping quotes from Camus? This guy loses a game where he doesn't play that well, and then he rushes right in talking about an invincible smile. Like some high schooler who just discovered philosophy for the first time. Hey, dude, did you go back home and change into black clothing and listen to Radiohead all night long? Crying out loud, man. Take it in stride. You're the GOAT. Start acting like it. I mean, you throw a couple of picks and you run right to Instagram and start dropping absurdist philosophy, trying to get right. What happens if you lose to Carolina on Sunday? Are we going to get some Kierkegaard? And if you think that was strange, if you think that was a strange overreaction, how about the reaction to what Bruce Arians had to say about Brady after that game? Remember, this is what his coach said after the game when Brady had those two interceptions.
One was a miscommunication between he and Mike, and he thought Mike was going down the middle. It's a different coverage. Mike read it right, and he should have bent across his face, but Tom just overthrew it. And the other one was a screen pass with an outlet called, and he threw the outlet, and it was a pick six. Bad decision.
Right, so not a big deal at all. He said one was a miscommunication, and the other was, quote, a bad decision. Not exactly lighting the alleged toughest guy ever on fire. And it sure isn't like Arians came flying into the media room looking to burn that place to the ground the way the women's basketball coach at Michigan did back in the day.
That's how I feel. Damn sick and tired of getting out rebounded. 25 offensive rebounds. First time we block out, we get called for a damn block out. We're pushing people. Meanwhile, they're on the other court grabbing rebounds, going over the top and grabbing them. We get one offensive rebound, the other get called for over the back. We don't block out very damn well, and we're not getting called, one or the other. That's where I'm frustrated. That's where my whole frustration comes in, offensive rebounds. The entire thing came down to offensive rebounds. They got every stinking offensive rebound, and we didn't get one of them. What else do you want to know?
That's about all we need to know. That's a guy who's got some things he's got to get off his chest. Not only was Arians not in that neighborhood, he wasn't even in the same zip code, but some folks heard his comments and started tripping. And in this case, some folks would include Brett Favre, who had this to say on his radio program.
True or not, I think the last person you want to call out after the first game of the year is Tom Brady. Now, maybe they had a mutual truce going into the game, going into the season. Hey, I'm going to be hard on you. I want the guys to know that we're going to treat you the same, even though technically I'm not. So are you okay with it? If they have that truce, great. If not, I think you're barking up the wrong tree.
All right, so I hear what the slinger is saying. Sort of. Not really. Actually, not at all. But it did work its way back to Arians, because when Arians was asked about those comments, this is what he had to say.
Tom and I are fine, so I don't really care what other people think. So it's just what he and I think. And we left the stadium fine. We showed up today fine. So there ain't nothing to talk about.
And that right there is the correct answer. He's right. There ain't nothing to talk about. By the way, I've got absolutely no problem with Arians saying what he said about Brady after the game. It's accountability. And yes, I know that Tom apparently responded to that loss by reading some absurdist philosophy from the 40s. But this guy should be able to take criticism without losing his bleep, without rushing to Instagram to address and then bottle all the hate for future use. And even on top of that, Arians corrected himself yesterday and said that Evans was the one who was at fault for that first pick, which is great. Like, Arians is demonstrating the accountability that he's calling for. He's practicing what he preaches. So if Brady has any problem with what Arians said on Sunday, then that is on Brady. And then it's a much bigger problem than the two picks he had on Sunday. I mean, seriously, if comments that benign are going to, quote, jeopardize the relationship with Arians and the entire season, then Brady is not who we thought he was. He's not that mentally tough dude who battles through everything. Everything we're told about this guy, everything he wants you to know about this guy, is how mentally tough he is. A guy who, after a fistful of rings and the greatest career in NFL history, is still the guy who gets fuel from being a sixth round pick. Oh, and by the way, did you know that Tom Brady was a sixth round pick? Crazy, right? I mean, that's something I thought would come up a little more often than it does. How come nobody talks about that? Anyway, did we all also forget that Brady was coached by Bill Belichick? Coached hard by Belichick for 2 decades. And that Brady himself is famous for screaming at his teammates when they don't do their job. So we're supposed to believe that this dude is just going to fold when somebody points out that he didn't do his job. You think that guy can't take criticism? It says here he can, but if he can't, and Brett Favre is right, and there's something to this, man, their season's already over then. If Brady thinks those comments are anything other than Arians stating a fact after the game, then this is going to be a disaster in Tampa. And there won't be enough existential philosophy in the world to fix that. I mean, this dude of all dudes rushing to the gram to address the, quote, hate after only one game is really, really strange. But then again, this is a really strange dude who plays really strange word games with his teammates.
You're going to have to cool off after this heated debate because it's the friendship test.
One of my favorites.
Oh, man. I think I know you to a T, but
I know you pretty well. I think this should be a piece of cake.
Me too. Here we go.
Yeah, that's hard to listen to. Hey, check this out. Are you looking for some new content? Peacock is the new streaming service from NBC Universal. Great entertainment is finally free. Peacock has live sports, daily highlights, timely docuseries, and exclusive access to Premier League. And the best of live events, 2020-2021 Premier League season with over 175 exclusive matches live streamed on Peacock. Plus coverage of the U.S. Open live from Wingfoot from September 17th through the 20th. Exclusive streaming destination of the 2021 Olympics as well. Real stories beautifully told documentaries that tell the otherwise untold stories of grit, perseverance, and triumph behind the athletes we love. I'm talking about the best of streaming, best of TV. You can watch for free and upgrade for more on your TV, tablet, or phone. Go to peacocktv.com to download and start streaming now. We are joined by Neil Brown. Neil, great to have you on. How are you?
Jim, doing well, man. How are you?
Good, good. Good to talk to you. So you start the year with that 56-10 win over Eastern Kentucky Saturday. How good, first of all, did it feel to be back playing football, and what did your team show you in the way it took care of its business?
Jim, I think for any college football team after this in the midst of a pandemic, to get on the field and play, I think it's a win. And for us to go out and take care of business like we should have done, frankly, we should have taken care of business in this opener. That's just a bonus. You know, to probably as emotional game as any I've played, you know, or coached in, just because so much went in behind the scenes to making it possible. But it was fun. It was a fun day. We didn't have any fans in the stands other than family, so that's unfortunate as well. But it was fun. We played a lot of young people, and we're better. How much better? We'll find out on September 26th, but we're definitely better than we were a year ago.
West Virginia head football coach Neil Brown joining us. You know, Neil, back to that point, I talked to Dabo Swinney on the show yesterday. In fact, I've talked to a number of coaches who did have a game, and they all are saying the exact same thing that you just said, that it was as emotional an opener as they had ever had. Can you kind of lay that out for me? Why were you so taken by that? Why was that such a moving opportunity?
I just think back. You know, we shut everything down here on March 12th. And really didn't see our kids again until June 15th. Couldn't work with them until, I think, July 24th. And it was such a turbulent time, not only with COVID-19, but social unrest, you know, just everything that's going on in our country. You know, I'm 40 years old, and I don't know if leadership's ever been more difficult. We're in the most probably social unrest time of my lifetime. There's probably more political tension now than any other point in my life. And this is the only pandemic that we've ever had during my lifetime. So there's so many things that are going into leadership and you're having to navigate through. And then there was a momentum that we were going to play early, and then it didn't look like we were going to play. And then, you know, there's been a couple different tides. And to finally, you know, get to the point where we got on the field in a safe manner, you know, we're testing 3 times a week, and following the procedures and the protocols, and seeing after an extended period of time that those work. I'm not saying they're perfect, but they do work, and they give you an opportunity to play. And so just to go through all that, to have an opportunity to go out and play was extremely rewarding, not only for myself, but for our entire staff and our team as well.
West Virginia head football coach Neil Brown joining us once again. You know, Neil, on that same point, when you talk about leadership and how it's more challenging now than it's ever been at any time in your life, I see exactly what you're talking about. But to back that up, you talked about the fact that when you do not get the results that you want, you need to go into self-reflection mode. Like, a lot of coaches might blame the players. They might blame a lack of depth. They can blame any number of things. Why was it important for you to go into self-reflection mode, and what did you learn from that process?
Well, I think you have to. I think as a leader, one of the most important things you can do is you always self-reflect. And it has to be the first question you have to ask is, what can I do better? You know, what can we do better from a preparation standpoint? What can we do better, you know, whether it's conditioning, strength building, team chemistry, schematics in all three phases, what can we do better? And I think you always, as a head coach, you got to look at yourself first. And I think that it's also every situation is not cookie cutter. You know, we're able to turn the Troy program around and pretty quickly. And we had 3 tremendous years there. You know, 31 wins over a 3-year period, 3 bowl wins. You talked about it at the top here. But each job's different. And you know, I think what we did is, and I'll just talk to the schematics of it. Last year, offensively, we really struggled to run the football, and what we tried to do is go back and really simplify how we taught everything and really refined how we practice and how we installed. And we saw the rewards in game one. We ran the ball for, you know, 325 plus yards. Now we've got to continue to do you know, I don't know if we'll run it for that many yards in the Big 12, but we've got to continue to have a plus rushing attack in our league. And that's just one example. You know, but I think you have to as a leader. You have to really look inward before you can look outward as far as fixing things.
Well, Sunil, you ran the ball really effectively. You had a couple of running backs rush for 123 yards and two TDs each. And then Jarrett Deggie was 19 to 25, 228 yards and three TDs. What did you make of the way he ran the offense?
I thought Deggie was extremely efficient. You know, he started our last three games last year and was still able to redshirt. He's played a lot of football. You know, he was a two-year starter at Bowling Green before he transferred here. He comes from a football family. His dad's a longtime high school football coach in the state of Texas. His brother, Seth, played for me at Texas Tech when I was a coordinator there. So a football family, loves the game, loves to study, loves to prepare. But I thought this was the most calm I'd seen him in a game. I thought he directed and managed the game extremely well. And I think it speaks well to what kind of seasons he's going to have. Our goal as a team is to be one of the most improved teams in the country. And for us to do that, several individuals are going to have high levels of improvement as well. And he's definitely one of them as a leader of our offense.
You also, in part of getting ready for this, you had separated the team into a gold group and a blue group. What was the separation based on? Was it years or something else, or was it more socially motivated?
So we've been extremely cautious during this entire pandemic. We were, you know, when the workouts could begin on June 15th, our guys never came into our building until actually the first day of fall camp. We set up weight rooms in the concourse of our stadium. We did treatment rehab outside. We worked in groups. And then when we started the six-week return to play, which there was 12 OTA, kind of NFL OTA-style workouts that you were allowed to have, what we did is we split our team into two units, a gold and a blue, and we didn't do it by depth chart or seniority or anything like that. What we did is we separated it by position. We made sure all the roommates were in the same on the same team, and then the guys that hung out together socially outside of football, the guys that we knew were going to spend time together regardless, we put those, and that's how we divided it up. And we did that during the 12 OTA workouts. We did that for the first full 2 weeks of fall camp. And we met and worked out, walkthroughs, practice, meals, all those things were done separately.
Neil Brown joining us for a few more moments. You know, Neil, at this time when people's attention span is so short, it seems like nobody wants to pick up a book. You and I have talked about your book club and your love of reading in the past. So I want to bring this up before you go. Earlier this year, you did a reading of Have You Filled a Bucket Today on Facebook with your kids. For those who have not read it, what is Have You Filled a Bucket Today? And why is that something adults should learn from as well?
I laugh because I ask my 5 and my 9-year-old that every day. And here's where it started. It started right here. There's a nursery school on our campus here at West Virginia University where students go and they train that are going to do pre-K, teach pre-K and kindergarten. And my son, Dax, who's 5, when he was 4 going to pre-K there, they have a theme for every year. And their last year's theme was about bucket fillers. And there's a great book that goes along with it that you're talking about. And it's basically the theme of the story is everybody has a bucket and you want to fill others' buckets. All right. And you fill others' buckets by building them up and positive comments and those things like that. And I laugh when you said that because I still ask my 5-year-old Dax and my 9-year-old Ansley before I let them out of the car, or before I leave the house, I'm like, hey, make sure you fill somebody's bucket today. So It's a good book for everybody that's listening that's a parent or a teacher out there. It's a great lesson to be learned in that book.
I'm so glad I asked you that because I feel like right before you came on, I was running around emptying the buckets of my staff. I think I need to hear that. Neil Brown, my guest, he's the head football coach.
I'm guilty of doing that too, Jim.
Joey Logano is my guest. Joey, it's great to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing good, Jim. How you been?
Good, good. In fact, let me rephrase that, Joey. Since you and I have spoken a couple of times over the course of the season, now that we are into September and into the playoffs, how are you doing and how is that vibe around your team?
Oh, it's game time. This is the best part of the year. I tell everyone it's like Christmas. You just don't you see that big prize at the end of these 10 weeks of the playoffs and see that championship trophy there. That's the goal. That's what you shoot for, and this is the opportunity ahead of us. We've been working all year preparing for these moments, and we've come out of the gates pretty strong here. A couple third-place finishes, leading laps in contention for a win, and we put ourselves in a pretty good spot for Bristol this weekend to get through the first round. So that's a good sign, and that intensity will keep ratcheting up as the playoffs go. But like I said, with the right attitude and enjoying every moment of it, and embracing the pressure, it ends up being a pretty fun experience.
Joey Logano joining us. He's the driver of the number 22 Shell Pennzoil Ford Mustang for Team Penske. I like that note or that thing you just said about embracing the pressure. Why is it so important to embrace the pressure, and how do you go about doing that?
I've missed the playoffs before and didn't have the pressure. I've learned that pressure is a privilege after that. That is an awful feeling, not having the pressure. You want to have that moment. So I think maybe the lessons I've learned that year in 2017 was probably the maybe the most valuable lesson of my career of how much you really want it when it's not there. So you value those moments when you're not in the battle that you want to be in.
We're talking to Joey Logano. You're not going to appreciate that. Now, you've had the two wins in Vegas and Phoenix, and then everything's shut down. Then it restarts. So it might have taken a little bit of time to rediscover your rhythm with this really unusual schedule, but now you're stacking top tens. What has been the biggest difference for you and the team of late?
Yeah, you know what it is? We're not practicing anymore, and that makes it kind of hard to grow a lot as a team. When we're out there working on our car and trying new things and tuning our car into where we want to, you're able to learn a lot before the race starts. Well, now everything we learn is post-race, and you can't make adjustments that the caliber of the ones that you want during the race. So you learn everything after the race, and you go to a racetrack that's not even close to the one you just raced at. And you got to wait a few months to go back to the same racetrack you just were at to actually learn something, to put what you've learned into use. So, that stuff is probably made our growing curve a little bit steeper than we wanted it to. With a new crew chief this year, new team, all those things, and obviously the social distancing and doing everything through, virtual meetings and all this, like it's just taken a longer time than expected. So trying to find a way that makes it worked during this pandemic as a team. And then, over time, getting our cars closer to where they need to be as soon as the race starts. And it seems like here lately, we've gotten a lot closer to start off and closer where we were earlier in the year.
We are talking to Joey Logano. Now, Joey, you've got a night race at Bristol, and there are going to be fans in the stands. How excited are you to see them back? And how aware are you of the fans during a race?
At Bristol, you're pretty aware of it. Bristol's a half-mile racetrack. It's the fastest half-mile we go to, high bank. They call it the last great Coliseum because it's literally like that. And, if you race there and nobody's there, it's a weird vibe. It's a stadium atmosphere. And we're in the All-Star race there a few months ago, and they had some fans there. And in here, once again, with fans, it just it lights the place up. Even with, 30,000 fans or so in there, it feels, I guess it's that many people can make a lot of noise still, whether it's during driver intros or before the race starts. You still see everybody's, camera phones flashing and stuff, especially during a night race like this. And it's honestly, Bristol's the best racetrack we go to. It really is. It puts on an amazing race. So it's cool to be able to put on a good show for the fans.
Joey Logano joining us here in the jungle. Joey, let me ask you about something that happened last month. It was announced that Eric Jones and Joe Gibbs Racing would be going their separate ways. Jones said that he was surprised by the news. The story goes that you and he may not be especially close, but when you saw that news, you reached out to him. Why was that, and what made you do so?
Yeah, well, it's a very similar story to what I've gone through, and I never really talked to Eric before that moment, but, I used to race for Joe Gibbs Racing, started there at a very young age. Didn't perform to the level that I needed to, and found myself out looking for a job. And kind of like I was talking about a minute ago about not making the playoffs. Well, and you learn so much in those moments. Well, it's the same thing when you lose your job. You learn more about yourself than ever, and who your real friends are, who's really behind you, and about yourself. What makes you tick, and having a second opportunity obviously is meant so much to me that I can show up as a, at the time, a 21-year-old, had 4 or 5 years experience and kind of knew what I wanted a little bit more. Well, he's just gone through the same exact story. So I felt obligated. I felt like I needed to say something and tell him about my experiences and maybe just bring his spirits up a little bit, because I remember those years being the hardest ones of my life. And it sounds so crazy because people are saying, oh, well, you're still a race car driver. What are you complaining about? But, you know, and that's true. That's 100% true. People are going through things way, way harder than that. But I do know for me personally, it was a hard time. And if I can help somebody through that, that's just the right thing to do.
I think that's really interesting. Like, he made the point that that lunch gave him hope because of the fact that you've gone on to win more than 20 races and a cup championship since. But to your other point, Joey, that, hey, how bad can it be? You're still a race car driver. Fact of the matter is, if you get fired, it's gonna rattle you, right? It's gonna get into your head a little bit. It might shake your confidence. Ultimately, you might be better in the way you come back from that, but that's understandable. How could you go through something like that and not have it affect you and not have it affect your confidence? It's going to.
There's no, of course. there's no way it doesn't, you know, and I know that I've lived through that. And you know, you going to a race where you feel like you have a team around you that doesn't believe in you. You can only imagine in any sport what that's like, you know, and you're not going to really perform to the level that you think you're capable of, because eventually you're going to believe the people that are around you. You know, it's the whole thing that your parents taught you, right? Tell me who you're hanging out with. I'll tell you how you're going to end up. You know, it's the same thing in a team environment. And, you know, like I said, just he has talent. He's been around the sport long enough. He's won races before. It's the same exact position I was in, and you just get in the right position at the right team, and, you know, 3 years later, four years later, we won the championship, you know? So, and if you told me that 4 years ago before that moment, I would never believe you. And so I just, like I said, just keep his hopes up and something will turn out.
You bet. It's a great story. Now, in the past, you and I have talked about the work that you and your family are doing with the Joey Logano Foundation. Last week, you announced that the foundation would be making 9 grants of $22,000 to charities to help kids in crisis and to provide COVID relief. What's it mean to you to be in a position where you can support organizations like that?
Yeah, and that's the why, right? That's the why you go racing. That's the why we do what we do, because honestly, at the end of the day, Jim, trophies are pretty empty, right? They're all empty cups. That's what they are. You know, if you can fill them up with love and passion and helping people, that's where they actually have a meaning and can do something. And that's what the Joey Logano Foundation is all about, the supporters of it. We've been able to do a lot of great things for COVID relief with a $1 million fund. And we went through that to really help a lot of individuals during this moment. And now getting back to our roots is giving second chances, like I got in my career, to children and young adults in times of crisis. So a lot of kids that have been put into the foster care system, group homes, you know, those type of things that people that need, you know, resources, role models, and things like that. So, yes, for the rest of the season here, last, you know, 8 weeks from now to the end now, we're doing $22,000 a week to these organizations, because as you can imagine, this year with what COVID is, getting the funding for things like this have kind of gone by the wayside. As so many people have their own issues they have to deal with, it makes it harder for them to make ends meet and to help these kids and have someone believe in them, right? That's what they need. They just need somebody to believe in what they can be and spark that little bit of fire inside of them. And it really turned out to be a contributing member of society. That's what we want these young, you know, men and women to be.
Hey, listen, did you know that a fire department responds to a fire every 24 seconds? October is Fire Prevention Month, and we have teamed up with First Alert, the most trusted brand in fire safety, to help you be ready for the unexpected and to review some key safety tips. As an example, smoke and carbon monoxide alarms help provide an early warning in the event of a home emergency. And having enough First Alert smoke and carbon monoxide alarms is one of the best things that you can do for your home and your family. Make sure you install alarms on every level and in every bedroom of your home. That is so critical. Once the alarms are installed, it's also important to maintain them by testing them with regularity. Also, remember, the alarms do not last forever, and they need to be replaced at least every 10 years. If you can't remember the last time that you replaced your alarm, it is best to replace that unit completely. And for a replacement option, my favorite is First Alert's combination smoke and carbon monoxide alarm with a 10-year sealed battery. This alarm provides 2-in-1 protection against smoke and carbon monoxide, and I don't have to change the battery for a decade. Lastly, take this time and discuss home safety with your family. Plan and practice an escape route, and remember to practice it at least twice a year. And for more information on fire safety products, safety tips, and educational activities that you can do at home with your family, just visit firstalert.com/fireprevention month. firstalert.com/fireprevention month. And my man Tim Connolly is all about softball guy. Tim, I normally would never have a guest on twice in 1 week, but then again, teams never come back from 3-1 deficits twice in the same postseason. How you doing, Tim? What's the week been like for you?
It's been crazy. Thanks for having me again. It's been wild. Down 3-1 to that team. Now you're trying to stay optimistic and positive, but the reality was pretty daunting. So proud of our guys and excited for Friday night.
Yeah, I'm curious, Tim, what was it like? You fall behind by 12 in the first half. You and I have talked about this, but you've come back from double digits each of the last two games prior. So on the one hand, you might say, hey, we got these guys right where we want them. But on the other hand, you might say asking for them to come back a third time from a double-digit deficit might be too much to ask. What were you thinking at that time?
We spent so much time between game 6 and 7 talking about how we can't fall behind again. We can't keep going to the same well. And when we went down double digits and it felt like they were giving a real punch, I didn't know if we had one more kick in us. And I thought Jamal's second quarter saved the game and allowed us to really believe we had a chance. And then we continued that momentum in the third quarter, and somehow, some way, we lucked out and got the win.
I was going to say, Tim, like when you think back on Tuesday night, you answered this in part already, but are there particular plays or moments that stick out to you more than the others?
I think there's lots. I think looking back at the series, I thought the moment Paul got into his little tiff with one of their guys, and Paul's a really, really chill guy, so it's not like him to nearly come to blows. I think from that moment, our team had a physicality and toughness that maybe wasn't evident up to that point. So I think series-wise, that would be it. And then game 7, when Jamal started cooking in the second quarter, it gave us life, and the double-digit lead turned into a 2-point halftime deficit, and then we were able to build off that and come out strong in the second half.
We're talking to Tim Connolly. You know, the first point you made is really intriguing, really interesting to me, because we're talking about chemistry and something you and I talked about earlier in the week. But when you have chemistry, from the outside, it seems like your team, your organization has amazing chemistry from the very top to the bottom. How would you describe it, and how important is it?
I think it's huge. I think it's certainly impactful for wins and losses, but it's just as impactful in the day-to-day. You just have more fun. Even when you're losing, it's a lot more fun to lose the people you respect and appreciate and support. So, we have our market, we have certain challenges that might not be inherent in other markets. So we've identified things that can be there from a day-to-day basis, and having fun and having chemistry and appreciating what your coworkers are doing is certainly something we can control, and it's something that we're very proud that it's evident, as you said, from ownership down to, the equipment guys. We're all on the same page.
We're talking to Tim Connolly. You know, Tim, when you first got to the bubble, you had 8 healthy players, just 8. Will Barton was not there. Jamal Murray was working his way back, and Gary Harris was working his way back too. What has the return of Harris meant specifically, and especially on defense against Utah and then against the Clippers?
It's been huge. I mean, Gary's such a good player, and we forget how young he is. He's turned 26 a couple days ago in the bubble. His physicality defensively, he's our shutdown corner. He's a guy that can move in space, a guy that plays with, a Michigan State tough guy approach on the defensive end. And our guys know how good he is defensively, and I think it's kind of weird. Like when you play with a big-time shot maker, sometimes you make more shots. I think when you play with a big-time defender, you feel a little bit more power, a little more confident to lock down your guy. And I think Gary's certainly allowed our team to do that.
I love that analogy that he's your shutdown corner. Let me ask you this. How much of your success on Tuesday night goes back to the battle to get into the postseason in 2018 and just missing, and then the battles in last year's playoffs, then the Utah series? Like, are we talking about scar tissue from coming close in 2018? Did that help lay the foundation for what we're seeing right now?
Yeah, absolutely. I think if you talk to our guys, and they were too young at the time to appreciate how much pressure we had going into that final game of that season. We basically had 7 or 8 do-or-die games. We weren't able to pull out that game. Minnesota lost in overtime. They're so accustomed to big games, and which is really, really hard to replicate any other way except playing those games, that how laid back they are is, it's encouraging. It can be frustrating, but it's certainly who they are and who we are. And our guys, you know, they like to play with a smile on their face, and they're not scared of the moment. And now we're 28 playoff games in, and the first three series, we have to go to game 7. It's pretty fascinating to watch that evolution and how just chill they are in their approach. And, you know, thankfully, it's worked out this far.
Talking to Tim Connolly, I want to ask you about your head coach in a minute, but actually I want to ask you about an assistant. You and I talked on Monday about Wes Unseld Jr. Then he got some more love during the broadcast on Tuesday and after the game. How would you describe his role on that staff? How critical is he to what you guys do?
He's the backbone of what we're doing. He's an unbelievably bright guy. I'm not sure many of us in our profession have econ degrees from school like Johns Hopkins. So he's so studious. He's a workaholic. And he and Mo have such a great relationship. And it's not just, you know, John's just Wes, our whole staff, David Adelman, Jordy Fernandez, those guys. It's been so fun being around that every minute of the day where you're constantly talking strategy, you're constantly talking personnel. You know, during a normal year, there's very few upsides in the bubble, but all you have is your coworkers and hoops. So the conversations are happening all the time. They're happening during the day. They happen over drinks late night. It's really fun to – I knew how good these guys were, but I have a whole new appreciation for them, seeing them every day for the last 75 days.
Well, the thing is, Tim, there is one more thing about that bubble. Legend has it there's a road which surrounds the hotel, and it's become really popular for coaches and executives to get out and walk or jog or do what they do. You've been known to hit that trail. I want to read you a quote from Chris Haynes. He said this about Michael Malone, quote, on a road bike in the sweltering heat and humidity, as if he's participating in the Tour de France, he zips through the course with blazing speed, then periodically pulls over to the side of the road and starts doing push-ups at a frantic pace. So have you seen these workouts in person? And if so, what do you make of them?
That's completely factual. 100% done. I'm a walker. He's a biker. You know, I was living downtown. He was living by the mountains. So he was really – the bike was a great release for him. So I love it. He's getting out there. He's on his beach cruiser. There's a couple obstacles because there's fences everywhere. He gets off the beach cruiser, knocks out some push-ups, clears his heads. And that's – Chris is dead on, and I love seeing it.
Tim Connolly joining us. You know, somebody else in your organization I want to ask you about is Calvin Booth, the GM. He withdrew his name from consideration as the Sacramento Kings head of basketball ops. So what does he mean to you and the organization? Where does he fit in?
He's a rock star. He's a guy that I met when he was a rookie in D.C. A guy as an active player was, you know, I always tell guys when they're still playing, the best time to get involved in something is when you're still a player, because the calls get answered a whole lot more quickly when you're still hooping. He actually, when he was an active player, he would fly himself to Europe and watch games the end of the season. He'd go to camps. The guy's obsessed with basketball. Really, really bright. He's going to be a president of basketball operations at some point really soon. He just has it all. And he's probably the biggest walker in the whole bubble. For a long time, it was me, Masai, and Adam Simon. The assistant GM for the Heat. We thought we had the record. But I think Calvin one day did, I think, 20 miles walking.
Tim, you mentioned Masai. I'm curious, in that bubble, when you guys are all there and you're running into each other and you can socialize, communicate, I mean, what's it like being in the same physical space with a bunch of people that normally you were just going to battle with?
You know, a lot of these guys are some of my best friends. Like, you know, Adam and Masai, we've been traveling the world together for 20 years. They've been great, great buddies when we were just trying to get paychecks in the NBA. So that's neat. What's weird, though, Jim, is it – your mood is certainly determined by the wins or loss. So, yeah. And when you come back, you still got to eat, you know. So you still got to go to the meal room. My meal room is right across from Lakers. There's only one or two restaurants here. You know, you don't have a lot of options if you're hungry unless you just want to get, you know, the overpriced Disney room service. So it's, you know, you lose. And the last thing you want to do is go walk by and see a jubilant Utah or Clippers team. So it's strange, man. It's certainly, again, the NBA has done such a great job making this as nice as possible, but as each series has progressed and the games get more and more important and there's less teams here, like right now there's only 4 teams, this massive property, and it's, you feel it, you know, you don't see anybody out, and it's weird, at times it's cool when you're the team lucky enough to win. Like we won the other night, we had a big party with all our players and staff, which was hilarious. But it's certainly weird.
It's got to be so weird. Tim Connelly joining us. You mentioned the Lakers. You've got them now in the conference finals. I know you and your guys are not going to be intimidated. I know you're not going to back down or blink. What kind of thoughts do you have when you think about tomorrow night and the series overall?
Right now, I just feel like a fan. I'm just, you know, I'm work for this team. I'm a fan of a lot of different teams. And I get most excited when the Orioles play the Yankees, you know, or you know, the Ravens play the Chiefs when you're playing against the best and there's nobody better than LeBron. So I'm so pumped to see where we stand against that organization, against that player. I mean, they have more than just him. AD is an absolute star as well. But I think it's going to be really fun. I think our guys they believe. You know, we've had it's been a long time coming to get ready for this level of basketball. We didn't get here quickly. You know, I mean, look at the year since Mo joined our team, since Nikola joined our team. I think they feel like they're ready for it, and we feel pretty confident that we're going to be a tough out.
You know, when you talk about LeBron, as somebody who's been in the game as long as you have, Tim, and especially on that side, personnel, president of basketball ops, when you see that guy at that age with that many miles performing at that high a level and seemingly having lost nothing at all, what kind of thoughts do you have?
The guy's amazing, man. He's an absolute – he's amazing. I don't know how many superlatives I could use, but even I was just walking by breakfast and seeing him, just he's such an imposing physical guy, and how he's able to move and how he's able at his age to play at this level and his commitment to his body in the game. And then that's not even mentioned what he's doing off the court. I mean, he's awesome. You won't find a bigger LeBron fan. I won't be a fan on Friday night, but that guy's a stud.
Tim Connelly, my guest. Tim, last thought. I've had you talk about pretty much everybody else. Let me ask you about you really quickly. When you talk about those days when you were just trying to get a check in the NBA, when you were an assistant video coordinator back in those days, was the goal always to be a GM and then president of basketball ops, or was it just to be around the game in some way, shape, or form and see what happens?
No, you know, it's funny. My goal was to be a director of player personnel, which is essentially the lead scout. I want to travel the world, and some days I still want that job back. I just want to watch hoops and pick players and try to influence the team formation. So, no, I never had a dream to be a GM. I was actively trying to get a job as a GA in college. It's funny, my parents moved a couple years ago. They had a couple of rejection letters from colleges. I just wanted to work in basketball. It could have been any sport at that point. I mean, I grew up huge, huge Orioles fan. That was probably my dream growing up. But I like sports. I like the camaraderie it brings. I like the diversity that it allows and who you're meeting and where you're different parts of the world you get to know. But I was never one of those guys that said, I want to run my own team. It was complete dumb luck.
I think you're running an amazing organization and operation. He is the president of basketball ops, and they finished off the Clippers in the seventh game. Next up, game one of the conference finals, Nuggets, Lakers, tomorrow night at 9 p.m. Eastern. And, Tim, like I said, we never, ever have a guest on twice in 1 week. But then again, your guys did something that's never been done before. So thanks for making time. Good luck tomorrow night. And I hope you can do it.
Thank you so much. It's funny, from the last time, I got like 50 softball guy texts. And then I got my buddy Flip keeps hitting me about gym guy. He's like, yeah, you got to ask about gym guy next time. They're all about it.
It's been about 36 hours now since the Clippers finished off that collapse. 36 hours later, that collapse is not any less spectacular. I mean, that was an implosion of epic proportions. Not just because they had a 3-1 series lead. Not just because they had double-digit leads in all three of those games. But because this was a team that was built to win a championship this year. Not contend. Not get to the postseason. Not go deep. But to win it all this year. They were built to win it all this year, and yet they're heading home in the same round as the Rockets. And the fallout is starting. We've already heard from CJ McCollum and Damian Lillard, and now former Clipper Josh Smith jumped into the fray as well. Before he joined the Clippers, Smith, you might recall, was on that Rockets team that came back from down 3-1 to beat the Clippers. So he posts a pic from that series on Instagram with the following caption, quote, "We've seen this movie before. In fact, I wrote the script. Hashtag by Doc. Hashtag the 3-1 bum." The 3-1 bum is how he hashtagged that. Like, I'm not exactly sure what kind of an axe that Smith has to grind with Doc. But that hashtag's a bit much. Doc Rivers, although you don't want that on your resume, the fact that he's been up 3-1 and lost 3 times, you don't want that on your resume, but it does make him a bum. Doc's definitely not a bum. Fact, not an opinion. Doc Rivers is no bum. Now, I know that series did not go well for him at all on any level, but calling him the 3-1 bum is absurd. And most of all, it's not opening the door for a particular brand of humor that some of you ghouls love so much. Keep moving on to something else, something better. Like this report from Chris Haynes. He shared this, quote, heated verbal exchange between Montrezl Harrell and Paul George in game 2. Quote, early in the second quarter, a struggling George had committed 2 careless turnovers in less than a minute. The second mishap was a half-court pass to Harrell, who was near the paint but surrounded by Murray and Michael Porter Jr. Murray picked off the pass. Seconds later, the Clippers called a timeout. Harrell approached his teammate about the risky pass, with George not taking responsibility and arguing that the pass could have been caught had Harrell made the right play, sources said. Let me jump in right there and just say, Man, if you commit 2 careless turnovers in less than a minute, when you're asked about it, you better not be saying that the pass should have been caught by the guy that it was intended to, who was already covered. And sure enough, as Haynes writes, quote, this set off the NBA sixth man of the year. Harrell responded with something along the lines of, quote, you're always right. Nobody can tell you anything. And expletives were uttered from both players, sources said. George eventually toned down his rhetoric, but a heated Harrell was not having it. Teammates began clapping on the sideline in part to disguise what was going on and in an attempt to defuse the situation, end quote. I mean, is that not the best? Look, exchanges happen on every single team in just about every single game. But you don't need teammates to clap on the sideline to drown out the argument and defuse the situation. And it goes to a larger issue that keeps coming up from Clipper players after they completed their swan dive, this notion of conditioning and chemistry. So let's talk conditioning for a minute. If that really, really is why they lost, then that is really, really weird and really, really lame. The Clippers were the team that was supposedly built on depth. Only 2 Clippers averaged more than 30 minutes per game in the playoffs. Jamal Murray is averaging more than 39. So how are you gassing out in the second round? I mean, let's not act like we just watched the NBA Finals. There are still at least 8 more games to win and the possibility of 14 more games to be played by the eventual champion. So how are they gassing out already? You can't gas out halfway there. Why are they not in shape? Yeah, I know they had to deal with some injuries, some guys leaving the bubble. But again, Denver showed up at the bubble with only 8 healthy players. So how is Denver in better shape physically at this point than LA? And don't go blaming the hiatus for the lack of conditioning. Every other team had to go through the same exact challenges in terms of staying in shape during the hiatus and then entering the bubble. Like Rajon Rondo. That guy had literally 1 practice in the past 6 months, and he's been playing just fine for the Lakers from a conditioning standpoint. LeBron James has played about 1 billion minutes in his career. He seems to be doing just fine from a conditioning standpoint. So how can conditioning be an issue, especially for a team that was all about load management the entire time? Yet they gassed out. Nobody wants to hear that. Same thing with chemistry. The aftermath of the loss to Denver was not the first time we've heard about the Clippers and their chemistry issues. You know, those issues that are currently brushed off or always were. I mean, what could be so bad about the Clippers' chemistry that it led them to blow double-digit leads in back-to-back-to-back closeout games? How does chemistry explain them getting up big and then bricking shots and getting torched on defense? And then repeating the same process the very next game. Chemistry. I mean, if that's the case, how badly would you have to hate your teammates to make sure that you jump out to an enormous lead and then just shut it down on offense and defense? That would be some legendarily bad chemistry. Like, the Lakers have an entirely new roster this year. Their chemistry is not an issue. The Heat added Jimmy Butler, and he's not for everybody. Their chemistry is better than ever. The Celtics added Kemba Walker. They didn't need a year to adjust to that. Yet, with the Clippers, it's their chemistry, and they just need more time. You know, you get right down to it. It's not about conditioning or chemistry. It's about the other C, choking. And if you're blaming conditioning or chemistry or even basketball IQ, as Kawhi did on Tuesday, then you're just not owning it. You're not owning your role in the situation. You're pointing the finger at something else and everybody else. Like, if you're out of shape, why are you out of shape? If the chemistry is bad, and we heard reports about this going back to January, why didn't they fix it? They didn't just show up in that series and all of a sudden realize, man, our chemistry sucks. It's too late to do anything about it. We've been hearing about that all year long. And one more question. Exactly who was the leader in that room? Who was the leader of that team, and who was the leader in that locker room? Or is there no one? Like Kawhi. Kawhi might be your best player, but he didn't have to be the leader in San Antonio or Toronto. He could just focus on being the best player. But in LA, there did not seem to be a leader. You know, like that when the bleep hits the fan, there was nobody who stood up and said, hey man, get the hell out of the way, I got this. If you're going to talk the trash that the Clippers talked, man, you better back it up. If you're going to gloss yourself, playoff P, you better deliver in the playoffs. If you want to be a champion, man, you better face the pressure and the scrutiny that comes along with it. And if you're going with Paul George's truly idiotic take that it's only year one, well, first of all, it's not only year one. This is not a rebuild. Again, this was a championship year. Everybody knew it. If Pandemic P doesn't know that, that might be a big part of the problem. But even if you think that it is year one, year two is not going to be any easier because the West was a gauntlet this season, and it's only going to get worse because Dallas is going to be even better next year. Zion is going to be healthy next year. Ja Morant will have a year under his belt. Minnesota is going to have more talent. Oh, and there's that team in the Bay Area, too, with three Hall of Famers that had to take a forced sabbatical this year, but they'll be back next year. Man, you keep hearing about what happened to the Clippers. You can talk all you want about chemistry and conditioning, but it really is about one thing, and one thing only. Choking.
Good night!